This episode is brought to you by Jamf Software. Jamf helps you bring the legendary Apple experience to your organization, whether you have 10 or 100,000 devices. Jamf helps you empower your end users to be more creative, productive, and happier, all while making your life easier as an admin. Find out more about them at jamf.com. That's JAMF.com. This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. This is a very special episode of the show because I am joined tonight by Nicholas Cole Farrell. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks so much.
It's good to have you
here. It's great to be here.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great to be here. This is my second appearance. I think I'm catching up with a couple of your guests. I'm not quite like Alec Baldwin on SNL level, but, you know, I'm getting there.
Yeah, you'll eventually get the Lifetime Achievement Award pretty soon. So remind everybody, or our thousands of new listeners since the last time, I'm sure, who you are and what you're all about.
It's actually good because my title has changed since the last time I was on, so this is a good chance to try that out. But my name is Nicholas Cole Farrell. I'm the Director of Technology and Making, and I work at the Brandeis School in San Francisco, California. It's super awesome to be here. As part of my work, I work with our one-to-one laptop program, but also am involved with our making and tinkering curriculum and sort of growing those spaces. So the last time I was on, with Bradley, so this is a good chance to get over here with Fraser. But Fraser, I'm still working on it.
I'll take everything that's going. It's fine.
Yeah. No, I've seen your the names on your Starbucks cups. They're an adventure for sure. But the last time I was on, we were just sort of launching our making program and our tinkering program. And so this is sort of a good chance for me to sort of come back, not so much to talk about that program, which is super fun and super fun to talk about. But Fraser and I think are going to talk a little bit about a pretty cool symposium that I had a chance to go to last week. And that I think, Fraser, did you get a chance to watch the live stream at all? Or?
I didn't get a chance to watch the live stream. And I know that there's an archive, which I have yet to watch as well. But I'm trying to keep it for the holidays because we're not too far away from the holidays. And I'm going to lock myself in a room for a day. So the reason that we're doing this show, that this special show, is because this was back in January 26. An event was held at MIT, which if I could give anything to go to an event in history, and this is fairly recent history, this one probably ranks right up there with my desire to have been at the 1995 concert in the park by Paul Simon. So,
oh right, yeah, that was pretty amazing. I wasn't there, but I watched that one definitely on TV and seeing that and being like that was a special time for sure. I mean, Art Garfunkel did not come out as a surprise guest at MIT last week, but
no.
Pretty much everyone else in this field was there. Save Fraser. Sorry, I'm not rubbing it in.
You don't even dare put me in this list. That is not fair. Okay.
But no, it was a really, really special event. I had said to someone that it's sort of like seeing the band that you've been following your whole life on a tour, just sort of that last tour. Unfortunately, a lot of the folks who sort of founded the MIT Media Lab are themselves getting well into their 60s and 70s. And unfortunately, as time marches on, we lose a few. And we lost a few last year, including Seymour Papert, who we're going to talk about today, as well as Edith Ackerman. So it was really a real great chance for the Media Lab to celebrate their work. And that was sort of the topic of the seminar. It was called Thinking About Seymour. And the puzzle, Fraser, is can you pull the quote that's related to?
I'm not going to get it correct, but it was something that Papert said about you can't think about something without thinking about it at the same time. Is that right?
Exactly.
I'll
give you the points on that one for sure.
Okay.
But you know, that's the idea. The idea is thinking about thinking and thinking about learning and what it looks like. And that was sort of a theme for the whole day. There were all kinds of folks from his life, both professionally and personally, and that was really, really pretty special. Both from his family, from his colleagues at MIT, and folks that just sort of knew him through collaborations here and there. So it was a great day to sort of celebrate his spirit. Someone joked at one point how strange it is that we're all in a room listening to people talk for someone who had such an issue with direct instruction.
Yes, absolutely.
And the irony was definitely not lost on the audience.
I'm sure. So for audience members who maybe are not that familiar with Seymour Papert, we should probably outline a little bit of his life and work. I mean, I think anybody who listens to this show is absolutely living and working in his shadow, and what a shadow he casts. But
That's it. Whether they know it or not, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, yeah. And I know when I first kind of discovered Seymour Papert a number of years ago through listening to one of the people who was speaking at this event, Gary Steger, I came to the realization that I had been doing a pale shadow of his work in a very amateurish fashion all the time I'd been working and teaching. So it was a very real kind of revelation to me to learn about his work a number of years ago now. But just to kind of outline the background, and I'll let you talk more about the details of the day, but, you know, Papert was born in South Africa, a mathematician and computer scientist who spent most of his career as a professor at MIT, working firstly in mathematics and then artificial intelligence with people like Marvin Minsky, who we also recently lost him as well, I think, didn't we?
Right, yeah, for sure.
And then finally in education, and many people of kind of my age and perhaps a little bit older who grew up in the very beginning era of computers coming into schools might remember a programming language called Logo, and a little turtle that sort of moved around, a little robotic thing that would move around the floor and draw things for you. And that was all part of his inventions. But to characterize Papert as just the inventor of Logo, I think, is a massive disservice to his work. And I think we'll definitely dig in a little more detail to what he did. And, of course, who he worked with as well, who he studied with. And there's a very interesting line of influence that goes all the way back to, you know, Jean Piaget himself, who Papert studied with in Geneva between 1958 and 1963. And of Papert, Piaget is said to have claimed that no one understands my ideas as well as Papert. So it's very interesting to me that line of influence continues, you know, right down to, in fact, the curriculum that I work on in Scotland as well.
Yeah, same here for sure. And for me, it's I first encountered Piaget when I was in teachers' college, and you know that sort of name stood out, and in a way the work you know definitely dovetails with Piaget's work, but it's sort of a plus one as well. You know, it sort of takes that work and brings it to a new spot, and in a way that sort of, we won't say contemporizes it. That seems a little facile, but it really brings another dynamic to it. And I think in your work, in my work, and as well as probably a large amount of the work of the listening audience as well, that's something that rings true.
So three major books, I think, that are maybe not the most his major works, although Mindstorms, his first book, is probably the best known, and certainly the name is very well known because, of course, the Lego organization took that name and used it for their line of programmable robots and Lego kits and things that are still sold to this day and sold in a lot of schools as well. So three big kind of breakout books for Papert are Mindstorms, : Children, Computers, and Powerful Ideas, which I think is one of your particular favorites. The one that I love is The Children's Machine, which is called, it's subtitled Rethinking School in the Age of the Computer. And listeners to the show will know that if you read that book, you'll basically hear me doing a bad version of quite a lot of the very powerful ideas in that book. And finally, one which I have not read, The Connected Family, Bridging the Digital Generation Gap. And I think I'm being a bit silly about this. I should probably read them all, but I'm sort of keeping it, you know.
I hear what you're saying. It's sort of like that third album from the band that you love so much. You're like, should I unwrap it? Should I give it a listen? Is it time? The Connected Family is interesting. Actually, at the symposium, there was a lot of talk about Mindstorms, right? That's really kind of in my mind and in others' minds, sort of the flagship work. And The Children's Machine is wonderful. I'm not trying to short sell that. But what was interesting is that The Connected Family, somebody had brought it up, and I have it in my notes, but they had mentioned it as sort of the way of bringing constructionism home. And I thought that was a really interesting way of approaching it, of sort of taking those ideas of constructionism, which we'll sort of get into and talk about a little bit, and what those look like in the home with multi-generational families, how students learn alongside their families. And I really like that idea. So I've picked through that one myself. I'm not that well versed in it. My copy is still in good shape. My Mindstorms copy, as I mentioned before we started recording, is pretty beaten up, and I'm pretty proud of that.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite part from that book that you want to read?
Well, actually, I have the second edition here, which is interesting for Apple historians out there. So, you know, for your Stephen Hacketts out there, the foreword to it is written by John Sculley. So that's kind of interesting in its own way. And in the foreword, he sort of links Papert's work with the early work at Apple Computer. And let's just sort of put this out here. This is somewhat American-centric, but in the foreword, Sculley mentions, America is perched on the edge of an economic cliff. Unless we make a concerted effort to bring educational system into sync with the rest of the global economy, we're in danger of supplying the rest of the world with low-wage work and losing out on the high-skill, high-wage economy that the rest of the world has moved towards. Interesting, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's so much in here. I can pull out a quote here or there, but one right here, it's up on page 32, but Papert says, the educator must be an anthropologist. The educator as anthropologist must work to understand which cultural materials are relevant to intellectual development. That was another theme of sort of the work of an educator of setting the stage for learning. And that's a practice that's sort of endemic and central to constructionism, of creating an environment for learning and facilitation rather than direct instruction.
That's fascinating, because we were literally just having a conversation in school today in the staff room about what I think is probably certainly a generational and probably a permanent shift towards learning from video. And I think the kind of thing you're talking about there, which cultural materials are relevant, and I think it is very, very easy for the academy as a whole to say, well, books are the highest form of knowledge and everything else is below that in some way. The internet is below that and video is further below that. But the whole idea of anthropology and trying to understand the young generation coming through, I can see us really having to make a very radical shift in terms of the way that we deliver, or even package, never mind deliver, but even just how do we present to students the fact that there is knowledge, and do we do it in their language or do we do it in our language? I think that is really going to be a big fight over the next maybe 10 to 15 years.
Yeah, it's that conversation about meeting students where they are, which is a really interesting one. And I think there's a lot of work going on with that. One of the ideas I think that for us in thinking about Papert is this idea of knowledge, of learning, and of thinking, right? And so the term epistemology, I'm sure you're pretty familiar with, but it's sort of this study of the theory of knowledge. And in the International Baccalaureate program, it's just this idea of theory of knowledge is kind of a core component of the educational program. And it's like that knowing about knowing, or that learning about knowing. And it's really interesting is that if that's sort of central to the learning that's happening in our classrooms, you know, it really kind of changes this idea. One of the speakers talked about how so much focus is put on pedagogy and curriculum, and so little focus is put on learning. And that's sort of the thing, is that when we think about education, so much of what we do is focused around this curriculum and this pedagogy, but so little is focused on the actual act of learning. And so Papert really kind of brings that into light for me.
Yeah, the book I'm holding here, the Children's Computer, it has a quote on the front of it which says, educators with a vested interest in the status quo will hate this book. It is about their demise.
I love that. It's like the please steal this book, right?
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
Great.
I think it's an interesting question to think about. Like, if you genuinely think about learning, you eventually work your way back to asking the question, well, what is to be learned?
Right.
And that's actually a terrifying question to ask, because you could look at that and say, well, what is not to be learned anymore? And I'm trying to think, you know, of all the subjects that have left the curriculum in my lifetime, there's only one, which is classics. You know, I learned Latin at school. I'm not actually that old. I just went to a school that thought quite highly of itself as being potentially a posh school. It wasn't particularly, but it thought that way.
Right.
And that is one of the very few subjects, if not perhaps the only subject, that has actually genuinely disappeared from the curriculum in my lifetime, for, and probably two generations.
Yeah, for us, it was this idea of shop or auto shop woodworking and things like that. But, you know, sort of the maker movement is kind of ushering that back in its own kind of way. But so, yeah, certainly Latin is sort of that thing. It reminds me of Max Fischer in Rushmore.
But the irony of the sort of coder movement was that a lot of people were going about saying, you know, coding is the new Latin. And I was thinking, that's a really terrible, you know, argument to use for bringing it back, because that's the only subject that we've got rid of. And you're comparing coding to that, you know. So,
yeah. Anyway,
yep. Can I read you a couple of quotes from the Children's Machine?
Which yeah, please do. Love? Please do.
Let's see. There's two that I like. In particular, and this is the one that kind of, I just keep thinking about it all the time. He's talking about computer literacy, and he says that literacy has come to be defined, particularly in the context of school, as a very minimal practical knowledge about computers. Someone who had so minimal a level of knowledge of reading, writing, and literature would be called illiterate. The same considerations ought to lead us to call someone who has an equally minimal knowledge about computers, computer illiterate. Moreover, the difference is not merely one of degree, but one of kinds of knowledge. When we say X is a very literate person, we do not mean that X is highly skilled at deciphering phonics. At the least, we imply that X knows literature, but beyond this, we mean that X has certain ways of understanding the world that derive from an acquaintance with literary culture. And this is a bit I've underlined. In the same way, the term computer literacy should refer to the kinds of knowing that derive from computer culture. And I wrote in the margin there, I scribbled years ago when I first wrote this, I said, this is as much about Instagram as it is about Scratch.
Yeah, absolutely. I love this. This is like the journal of our learning. This is really great. Exactly. I have the same with Mindstorms, and kind of a similar theme. In Mindstorms, Papert talks about Mathland. I don't know if you're familiar with this concept. And he has this sort of ongoing analogy that to learn French properly, you need to live in France. And, you know, by no means is that to slag off the foreign language instructors in non-French-speaking countries, but this idea that you need to be one with the culture in order to fully absorb. And his idea is that in order to learn math, you need to be in math land, right? And where is that? It's no place specific, but it's about sort of diving into that culture and that way of knowing. And one thing that's really interesting is that I often hear this from adults that saying, "Oh, well, you know, I'm terrible at math. I don't have a mind for math, right?"
Yeah.
And I remember somebody saying to me, "That's one of the most damaging things we can do to students is give them that out and say, oh, yeah, well, you know, you're not a math person, so don't worry about it. You can just sort of dismiss that style of learning." But you know, there's this idea, and during the symposium, Papert's widow spoke about this. She said, you know, we spend so much time trying to teach children math that they don't enjoy. What would happen if we gave them math that they would enjoy? And it's a really interesting approach. And by not giving this opportunity for children to sort of define themselves by their limitations, you know, we're sort of By doing that, we're reinforcing this idea that you are either good at this or you're bad at this, but there's no middle ground. And as an educator, that really feels like giving up, you know?
Yeah, there's no growth mindset in that attitude.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So that was another piece. In fact, someone had said that during the symposium, and I just sort of stood up and clapped, and I was the only one. And everyone was like, "Good for you!" And somebody shushed me, and I was like, "Well, whatever. I'm going to be punk rock about this because that resounded with me for sure."
Yeah, most definitely. So tell us a little bit more about the event itself. I mean, firstly, my question to you is, how on earth did you get there? You flew in a plane, right?
Well, I flew in a plane.
How did it come
to
be that you were there?
I don't know. This is a little inside baseball. I don't want to give away my leads, but I have a friend who knows someone. But no, it sort of came to my attention that the event was happening, and through some through some anonymous sources, I was able to secure an invitation, and I was so thankful to be there. In a way, it was kind of interesting. I grew up right in that area, in the Boston area. So it was an interesting homecoming for me to sort of be coming back. And I had been to the MIT campus before. Sorry, for those of you who don't know, it's the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. It's in Cambridge, Massachusetts, just across the river from Boston. I'd been to the campus before in high school, I think, for a field trip or something like that. But sort of going to the media lab is, for you, Fraser, it's sort of like all you imagine it would be. It was absolutely phenomenal. The media lab is part of the School of Architecture, which is also pretty interesting in its own way. If you think of where that's going to fit in within the predominantly science curriculum of MIT, it exists there, in the School of Architecture. And in itself, it's sort of like its own... I don't know. It's almost like an incubator in a way. There's the lifelong kindergarten program that Mitchell Resnick heads up, and they do some pretty phenomenal work. You might have heard of Scratch, which we mentioned before. That came through from the work of the LLK group. There's a lot of collaboration that they do with the Lego group out of Denmark. You might be familiar with them and their bricks. I stepped on a few this morning.
I was going to say, I've got the imprint embedded in my foot, yes.
Yeah. There was my son, luckily, my mother is quite an archivist of my childhood and saved all of my Lego brick from the 80s. Wow. And so we're slowly rolling them out to our children. And I kind of do feel like the father in the Lego movie, just sort of being like, don't touch it, we have to glue it in place. This is, you know, but we're sort of, my wife and I are learning to let go, which is also its own kind of fun parental lesson, but I digress. The symposium was phenomenal, and it was on this past Thursday morning. And just to add to sort of the sense of adventure, I had gone on a red eye flight the night before from San Francisco, so I sort of showed up at the media lab somewhat bleary eyed, but was completely energized by the lessons there during the day. It was moderated by this gentleman, Ira Flatow, who hosts the Science Friday podcast on NPR. For those science geeks out there, that was also pretty exciting. But it was sort of it was formatted around the ideas of rethinking. And so there was a number of subjects that were sort of rethought. This idea of media, which was Nicholas Negroponte, who I think, Fraser, you're familiar with his work. But he's been on the MIT faculty since the 60s. And he was a co-creator of the Media Lab in the mid-80s with Jerome Wiesner. Let me see. So Rethinking Media with Negroponte, Rethinking Learning with Mitchell Resnick, who we talked about before from the Lifelong Kindergarten Program. Excuse me. Rethinking Making, Rethinking Objects, Laptops, which is a particular interesting one. Maybe we can touch on that with Senator King from the state of Maine. Very interesting there as well. At least touching back to your unofficial history of the first iPad deployment last week, it's kind of a nice bookend to that. Rethinking School, Rethinking Ideas with Alan Kay, which I think you would have loved to have been there for that piece. Yeah. Rethinking Math, which was interesting as well. Then there was a conversation with Professor Papert's widow, Suzanne Macy Papert, who herself is absolutely phenomenal. She worked as a Russian cultural translator for President Reagan in the 80s, which is fascinating, right?
Yeah, a key position, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Then there was rethinking thinking, which itself is kind of meta. Rethinking the world, as well as the final piece was rethinking play with Kjeld Christensen, the former CEO of Lego. Okay. So there were a number of panelists throughout the day, and again, absolutely fascinating to see all of these different pieces of Professor Papert's work, and sort of a note to add. Edith Ackerman, or Edith Ackerman, who's a Swiss developmental psychologist and learning researcher, she was meant to be one of the speakers and unfortunately passed away on on Christmas Eve this past year. So that was really kind of a sad moment. I was really looking forward to hearing her and hearing about her work. But she was really instrumental. She worked with Papert on developing the Lego Mindstorms program, which you discussed earlier for sure. But she also herself studied with Piaget in Geneva and in a way kind of synthesized the work of Piaget and Papert in her own way and really added an element of tinkering. She's done a lot of work with the Exploratorium, which is a top-notch, you can't quite call it a museum, science learning center here in San Francisco.
Okay.
And so, yeah, it was just really a really, really special day.
I think
I've said that six times already.
I completely believe you. I mean, I think I mean, the names that you said there and some others, I think everybody listening will know at least one of those names as somebody who's profoundly influential in this field. I was just going to mention that Nicholas Negroponte had a huge impact on my life through his book Being Digital, which was his sort of pop science book about digital culture back in 1995. You know, I graduated high school in 96 and went to university, and I sort of credit that book.
Oh, you're just a kid.
Whatever. That's not what they tell me anymore at school.
I'm just a couple of years behind you, sir. Yeah. Don't worry. The gray in my beard gives me away these things.
That's why I shave every day, just because nobody can see it. But that book, Being Digital, had a huge impact in my thinking at that time, and I would credit that book probably with leading me in or keeping me into computer science, because I was about to go to university for English language and economics. And that book kind of changed my mind on my career path, I suppose, and made me kind of keep computer science in the mix for a couple of years at university, and then eventually kind of fell in love with the subject and made that my final degree. So, yeah.
That's excellent.
That's a book
That's really great to be able to point back to that. Otherwise, you would have been like Josiah Bartlett down the sort of economics professor path, right?
Yeah, that would have been me. And then eventually president, who knows? I don't know.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. I think I was already disqualified from that, but what can you say?
I'm trying really hard. We've made it. We've made it so far in this conversation with discussing American politics. I'm sorry. Yeah, it's just like it's in my ear at every moment.
I can hear something ticking in the background, and it's eventually going to blow.
That was actually one of the most phenomenal things, is that this past Thursday at the symposium, it did come up now and again, but it was generally just a discussion and a really both reminiscing and forward-facing discussion about pedagogy, learning, and Papert's work, and there's not many things that can sort of distract the ear of Americans these days, but that one really made a difference on Thursday for sure. I can say that.
Yeah, that's great. So, of all of these sessions, which one stood out for you the most in terms of? Let's go with maybe, you know, its immediate impact on your work or your thinking at this point. I'll maybe ask you for some other, which one did you love the best or something later on. But in terms of impact or immediate relevance, what stood out the most?
You know, I was really, for me, the idea of rethinking making really stood out to me in sort of my day-to-day work. It was a pretty interesting panel of folks and sort of, for me, it's some folks that I actually know personally, as well as a few that I've sort of admired from afar. So that panel had Dale Dougherty, who is sort of the founder of the Make movement, or sort of the Maker movement in its way, is that Make magazine, and now through his work with Make Education. It was great. He's a Bay Area fellow. Sorry, this is kind of Bay Area centric in this way. But and then also so Brian Silverman, who had worked with Professor Papert, Gary Steger, who you mentioned before, as well as Karen Wilkinson, who is the director of the Tinkering Studio at the Exploratorium here in town. That panel, that group really. Their talks really stood out to me, and it was really around this common theme of Papert's work and the influence on making. That was the one that really, like, that was that moment where I sort of stood up and clapped and everyone stared at me. Like, I can say literally that was the one that affected me the most.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I heard Gary Steger speaking at a TED Ed event in New York a number of years ago, and that was kind of my introduction through him and his connection to Papert, and all the way through. And that was kind of where I, because that was just a few years after I had kind of started working with the one-to-one iPad program. I want to say maybe 2012 or 2013. And I was visiting a school in Brooklyn that week, and somebody just said, you know, this thing's happening tomorrow, why don't you come along and
those are the best, right? Yeah. Those are the best. Yeah.
Yeah, it was phenomenal. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Dr. Steger is great. There was a great quote. I just sort of jotted it down in my notes here. And he said, turns out there's never a time when you need more than 1 to 2 minutes of instruction. Mm. And I think that's a really fascinating way of sort of saying it. You know, it's somewhat controversial. There's certainly moments when more direct instruction is needed. But at least it sort of pushes us to this idea of what our teaching looks like and what learning looks like. And do students learn the most from a large amount of direct instruction, or is it more effective to have sort of a prompt, right? Mm-hmm. I like Gary's approach is that, you know, sometimes he really kind of just puts it out there and lets folks react to it. And that one really was sort of like, there were a lot of like chin scratches and nods in the room when he had said that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think for people who are unfamiliar with his writing and work, I think you have to learn to take it in a certain way. Would that be fair to say?
Certainly. Yeah.
He's very much into that kind of, I don't want to call it exaggeration, but almost overstatement is kind of his stock and trade, you know?
Yeah, it's very provocative. And I really like that about it, is that it's sort of, in a way that's, you know, like not to overstate it, but that was sort of the feeling I got about Professor Papert, is that without realizing it, he himself was maybe a little bit punk rock. Like he really kind of took these institutions on, and I was really impressed with all of the panelists were able to sort of discuss how he was able to get his message through and really work with teachers, work with university folks, and work with students. And they really sort of underlined how much he enjoyed working with students. And I think that that's often something, at least, I don't know about you and your work, Fraser, but for me, that's always sort of that moment when I'm reminded, oh, yeah, this is exactly why we're doing this. This is why I'm in the education game, is to work with students. Meeting with adults is really well and fine, and there's a lot of policy that we come up with and a lot of great ideas. But those moments when we can be in the classroom with our students, that's sort of like, you know, that's it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always have to remind myself about that, because I'm very much of the kind of personality type that wants to sort of design the world, you know, and I want to kind of like be the guy in Westworld that builds the robots, you know, and then I just want to kind of let
wait, wait, sorry, sorry, we need the, spoiler horn. Sorry, Syracuse will get us. Hang on.
Yeah. So there's something about robots, right? But that's kind of my feeling about school, my natural attitude to school is like, I'm going to set up the pieces on this chessboard and then the game is going to play itself and we'll just see how it all works out. And it's so wrong, but I have to just keep reminding myself how wrong it actually is. And that children are actually people too. And, you know, I'm painting myself as the most appalling teacher here, but I'm trying to describe to you.
Come on, please. Please. You're just being British at this point. Come on.
Maybe. But I'm trying to describe to you the natural bent of my mind and then how, like, almost all of my career has been a job to change my understanding of how people work, because, I mean, I'm a computer scientist at heart, not really a people person as such. Right. So what am I doing in this job, you might ask? But I think it's, you're right, and from more and more I'm trying to build those conditions to have those moments for more students. Because in my early years as a teacher, I always had those moments with, like, the best students, if you know what I mean, like the people who got them and they got me pretty much straight away, and we had a great time together. But for the other students who didn't get it, I was, as a young teacher, maybe unsympathetic, or, you know, just, or maybe just didn't understand how to connect to people who didn't immediately get.
No, that's it. That's harder. I mean, that's harder work, and that's the work, right?
Yeah, that is the work. You're right. Yeah.
I'm just kind of plowing through my notes here, but looking at my notes from Mitch Resnick's talk on rethinking learning, he said, you don't create plants, you create the conditions that in which those plants thrive. And I think that that sort of speaks to it. And I think that was part, I sort of had like a tweet storm during it, and it was really fun. And that was sort of my way of capturing as much. So if you're sort of into looking back on people's Twitter feeds, ignore all the things I say about home renovation and this and that. But last Thursday, I really kind of tried to capture as much information that was coming our way. But this idea of not creating the plants, but creating the conditions in which those plants thrive, that really spoke to me. And I think that kind of speaks exactly to the point that you were making.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of leaving that legacy. You know, what does it say in Hamilton? You know, what is a legacy? It's planting seeds in a garden you never get to see. That's one of the...
I know. I'm ready to start this Hamilton podcast with you. Let's do it. You're going the summer, or are you going in the winter?
In January 2018, the London tickets just opened a couple of days ago.
So okay, excellent.
We bought tickets for a year hence.
All right, well, if my wife can't make it this summer, you're in with me in San Francisco. How's
awesome.
That?
That's a deal.
Good. Deal. Done. Cool. Sorry, listeners.
Yeah, we'll do a special episode on that as well.
Yeah, please.
let me ask you a little bit about Sherry Turkle, because I first came to awareness of her work through her book Alone Together, which to me, I had a very bad reaction to her work at the start, because I took her work to be quite reactionary, and I think that was a completely wrong interpretation. But you know, it was kind of in the same vein as books like Bowling Alone and things like that, and the whole kind of movement of screen time must be managed and children must be taken off computers and stuff. And I think that's a very wrong.
A similar note, she had a sort of a quick interview in the documentary film Screenagers as well, and it was sort of this. I don't know. I wasn't exactly sure how to take it at the time, but hearing her speak, it's really fascinating the work that she has done over the years at the Media Lab, and the work that's both was sort of in collaboration with Papert as well as sort of adjacent to Papert. And in a way, it's sort of it's about thinking about what objects look like, and that was sort of her topic was rethinking objects and what people's relationship to objects is. And so it was sometimes there were moments where I found myself definitely like, yeah, this is it, absolutely, I get this, and literally standing up and clapping, and other moments where I felt definitely intellectually challenged and When Sherry Turkle got up, that was definitely one where I really kind of had to think as I was going and be like, oh, absolutely. Did you want to talk a little bit about physical objects and our relationships to them and what that impact looks like, both through Papert's work or sort of looking forward? Would that be something that would be worthwhile conversation?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's kind of peak. Okay. It's kind of peak Media Lab, that, isn't it? You know, the idea of the tangible and the intangible. You know,
right?
I mean, I grew up in university times, like studying, you know, paper after paper of stuff that came out of Media Lab in those days about things like tangible user interfaces. I was really into user interface at university.
Yeah.
And they had so many of those kind of pioneering research projects about things like, if you instrument a room with cameras and then you move little shapes about, how does that change your relationship to objects and things like that, and this is kind of the next level of that kind of stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the great things about Sherry Turkle's talk is that on the screen, her first slide was an original edition print of Mindstorms, and I just sort of like immediately pulled out my mobile phone and tried to like start looking at Amazon to see if somebody was selling it, and I hadn't realized what it was, but alas, somebody scooped them all up. Yeah. So that was sort of my other side work. But Turkle was talking about this idea of measuring success by the way in which your students fall in love with their objects. So this idea, like you were saying before, whether, you know, we were joking about this kind of peak Media Lab, is that the, you know, so the tangible and the intangible meeting. And Turkle's work is definitely right around that idea. What do you think that, in sort of knowing what you know of her work, is there anything that you see sort of in our kind of modern society that speaks to that? Or?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that there's something that happened in my life that has stuck with me ever since it happened, which was when the Amazon Echo came out in the UK, I bought one. And I set it up on my desk, and I talked to Georgia about it, and she said, "What's that?" And Georgia's like 3 years old, right? And I said,
"Right,
well,
yeah, I've got one of those too."
Yeah, yeah. and I said, "Well, this is Alexa," and I demonstrated interacting with this machine. And after a few days, I sent it back because many of the UK features didn't work very well and so on.
Yeah.
But for about 4 or 5 weeks after that, Georgia kept asking me, "Where's Alexa gone?" And that hit me like a train. And she kept asking me, like, "Where's Alexa gone?" And I had to explain to her that I sent Alexa back. And I sent away this friend that she was going to make, you know. And, like,
yeah,
I actually feel really terrible about it. And I have from time to time thought about buying another Amazon Echo to have Alexa back in the house for Georgia.
Yeah, I'll post you a dot. I'll spend the $39 and send one your way. How's that?
Okay.
No, that's really, yeah, it's really interesting to think about what that object looks like in your home. So in my own family, I have a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old. So my youngest, I think, is right around the same age as your youngest. My kids have trouble delineating the different voice assistants that are in our house. And I mean, we don't have that many. We have the one associated with the Apple devices. We won't say it by name because we don't want to set anyone's off. But we have that both on, you know, mobile phones as well as on, you know, the remote control that's with our television. And then we also have the one that's in our kitchen, and that's the Amazon Echo. And we're still trying to figure out, like, what do we ask those things, and what role do those have in our home? You know, the Echo kind of gets plugged and unplugged every once in a while. We sort of pull it out and be like, we're not sure we want this around. And then, but yeah, it's interesting to see our children interact with them. And that's an interesting story about your youngest there with it. Like, yeah. Where did that go? Is that part of our house? And is that part of our life and our family culture for sure?
Because I'm thinking, you know, like George is the same age that Beth was. Is that right? No. Georgia is now the same age when Alexa came into the house that my oldest daughter April was when our middle daughter Beth was born.
Okay.
I was thinking, well, what if I had kept that? Would Georgia like grow up thinking that that was like a member of the family? You know, like
so. Wait. I'm going to stop you right there. Know? Maybe this is like the baby sibling that my youngest is asking for. Maybe this is it. Maybe our computer, we changed the keyword, now we can say computer. Maybe computer will be the younger sibling, or at least the, you know, the person, the conversationalist for our youngest. Interesting.
So what you need to do is get that, get a doll, carve out the insides, put an Amazon Echo inside it, and here's your new baby. Yeah.
All right, that's it. BRB. Podcast ends now.
But isn't there, there's another very interesting aspect to that whole thing, which is not just the personality or the semi-humanity that young children will endow in a voice assistant like that, but also the way that adults treat a voice assistant ethically, right? And because if the way, think about the way you speak to you know, the voice assistant on your iPhone or the voice assistant in your Echo, you give them orders almost like a servant, or indeed even like I'll go as far as to say like a slave. Like, is that the kind of interaction that you want to model for your children in the house?
That's it. That's it, too. And another, and I'm going to sort of plus one on that, the tone that you take when addressing it. I'm not sure how you speak with your voice assistants, but I speak – in a very clear and precise manner. Mm-hmm. I'm not the biggest mumbler in the world, but I really sort of overcompensate when speaking. It almost reminds me of having been an English teacher abroad, how I sort of really focus on my diction and my delivery and sort of hopefully try to neutralize any regional accents I might have. But I find myself doing that with the voice assistants. And, you know, in a way, what model does that show our children as well is interesting to think about.
Yeah. And then you go even further than that again and say, well, like, Siri doesn't always get it right. And then we get really mad at Siri for making a mistake.
Yeah.
You know, we get really
what's our threshold for frustration?
Yeah. Oh, there's so much to think about in that. That could be a podcast all in itself.
Yeah. All right. So let's make our list. We got our Hamilton podcast coming. We've got this one.
Yep.
Sorry to keep you busy, but yeah.
Yeah, I'm just going to quit teaching and just podcast all the time. So I think one of the people that I was delighted to see on the roster for this event, who is somebody who doesn't have enough name recognition, is Senator Angus King of Maine.
Yeah.
Who, as Governor King, and you know, people who don't know the history of all of this area, the reason he is important in our field is that he was the governor of Maine when the Maine Learning Technology Initiative was started in 2002, which was, people don't even necessarily know that name, but they know that at one point in the history, Maine bought 50,000 iBooks from Apple and gave one to every student in the state. And for me, that puts him right up there as one of the most important, perhaps, politicians in educational technology. And I think I'd love to hear kind of what he said and how he tried to encourage people to rethink laptops.
Right. Yeah. So having Senator King was a real treat for me as well. And for me as well, the Maine Laptops Program has always been kind of a touchstone mm-hmm. for the work that I've done here. But he sort of went through this idea of how the program developed and how Professor Papert worked with him on putting this in place. And he had sort of talked about some of the political issues they ran into, but the short of it was something that was really, really, really telling. And he said, and this is sort of the last piece, he joined us via teleconference. He said, this program is about teaching and learning. This is not a technology project. And that piece, I think, like for listeners of this program, and for my work, and I'm sure for your work as well, is like, that's it. The best technology program we could have, if we're talking about devices, is by focusing on teaching and learning. And it's not about the kit, as my friend would say. It's about the learning and the teaching that's happening. And hearing that from Senator King was just like, yes, this is it. And that was almost another one of those like stand up and cheer moments. But that really spoke to me about like, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I always, you know, I remember back in, you know, we were talking in one of the recent shows about the prehistory of, or the official history of our one-to-one program. And that was at the time in 2010, there were very few things online about one-to-one programs. You know, there certainly were some, and Maine was, I don't think, the first school, or certainly, not certainly, but possibly the first kind of large-scale deployment like that, but there were certainly schools before that, you know, and of course there's a school in Australia whose name I am blanking on right now was the first school in the world. It's a girls' school in Melbourne, I think. There's a book about it called Never Mind the Laptops, which I think is quite an interesting parallel with again, the theme there.
Yeah, and punk rock shows its roots again.
Absolutely,
that?
Yeah. I'll put the link to the show notes and to that book in the show notes once I find out what it was.
Right. It's really interesting to think about, and in a lot of ways, during Senator King's talk and then a lot of the discussion about Papert, I had to sort of step back and keep telling myself when these things happened. Right. So with Senator King, they're talking about 2002. And so for older folks like Fraser and myself, like, oh, okay, that's, you know, that's recently. You know, like, we're talking 15 years ago.
Yep.
And when we're talking about Papert's, we're talking about like the 70s and the 80s. I was reading passages from Mindstorms to my wife, who's an educator. I was reading some last night. And it was sort of this, like, you know, the old history teacher challenge of, like, I'm going to read you three passages and you tell me what era the history textbook is from, you know. But I was reading her some passages, and I sort of, each time I was like, this is from 1980. This is from 1980. And it's so fascinating that to think about those, you know, this this approach and how much it sort of has influenced not only our work but so many other people's work, and how it just keeps kind of spinning out and spinning out, and you know, this idea of predicting the future, and it's somewhat cliche, but a lot of the work that we saw with Papert really did kind of presage what we're seeing now in 2017.
Let me use that as a great segue to somebody else I want to hear about, Alan Kay, who, if I'm not mistaken, did in fact have the great quote. He's had many great quotes in his career, but the best way to predict the future is to invent it. That was Alan Kay.
Right. Yeah. And they're also like, yeah, he plays guitar too. Like, that, this is like the most humble introduction, right? He's a jazz guitar player. Like,
yeah.
What are you talking about? it's like introducing you as a rugby fan, you know. It's like, come on. Come on. Kay was really fascinating. For me, it was just like sitting there, I was just sort of like, yes, that's it, that's the person, that's the woman, that's the man that said this. And Kay's talk was about rethinking ideas, and he was talking about how through his work this idea that you need to sort of process as part of your work in order to debug ideas. And that's something that we're sort of looking at here. Sorry, I'm recording here from our school, the Brandeis School. We're looking at what process looks like in terms of assessment. Mm-hmm. And how process is sort of central to a method of assessment for this style of learning. And hearing Kay bring that up was really kind of resonated, is that whether we say growth mindset, whether we say reflective, whatever we say, we need to think about it in terms of having putting a value on the process and understanding that process is part of learning. It's not necessarily the end outcome that we're focused on, but really that journey.
So you're talking about the idea that part of the assessment would be, did you follow the process that was defined for whatever
exactly
you're trying to do?
And also like putting a central focus on process as a thing itself. Mm-hmm. One of the ideas, and it's like, you know, it's currently on my educational tombstone, if I had to have a tombstone for the work that I've been doing, but this idea of the product of what is it? The product of process is reflection, not product. So that in a way that as you're making something, maybe for us, we see the tangible outcome, but we need to think about what the value of reflecting on the process is, and how that can figure into our understanding of the value of something.
Interesting.
I'm still working on it. That's a lot to inscribe on one tombstone.
Oh, there is. Yeah, you'll have to get a tall one for that. But that's fascinating, because I think, you know, in our notes here, and people can't see the notes, but I've got a section later on which says hard questions for constructivism, and the first one is just,
I'm glad you put those in there. I was like, oh gosh,
obsessing me right now, and has been for years, right? That we did our one-to-one program, and we did it at a time where, like, the Scottish government were rolling their the new kind of constructivist curriculum from the ground up. So they were going from like K through 12 in that order. Mm. And we came into it about the point where maybe grades like 5, 6, 7 were starting to come online. And we had a great opportunity there to do both, you know, a high-tech program, but also very kind of progressive education at the same time. And we had a couple of like golden years in there where we did unbelievable things that we never had a chance to do before, and we've never done since because the constraints of the assessment system came in after that. I think we're facing a very quite serious crisis actually in Scotland, I think, because we have a very constructivist early curriculum in schools, and we have a very, very didactic exam system. And the two are constantly grinding against each other like a glacier. And
Actually makes me think of something I remember hearing you say on previous episodes, not to get too sort of like inside baseball in this, but this idea that we're teaching collaboration across the early years, and then we're celebrating individual work through sort of the upper middle and what we would call the high school years here, and through university, and then when folks get out into the workforce, we're asking them, "Oh, you've got to be a collaborator. You've got to work as part of a team." Yeah. And how that narrative doesn't necessarily pass through the years is kind of the challenge that we're looking at here in the United States, and I'm sure that you all are looking at there in the UK. Is that how can we sort of square that?
I wish we were looking at that. That's kind of an ongoing thing. I don't know that we actually are.
Yeah. All right. Then let's start looking at it. That's another podcast. Let's do it.
No, yeah, definitely. I mean, I think there's a lot of focus at the moment in terms of like bureaucracy and stuff at upper school level in Scotland. But I think I'm not saying nobody has understood that problem exists, but nobody is yet doing anything about it. I think perhaps because what it means is this exam system we've just rebuilt, we actually have to rebuild again immediately. And nobody can actually live with the consequences of that. So I think we're in season 4 of The Wire at this point. But we're making so many references. I hope people are getting tonight.
We're going deep, and I like it. I like it. That's another one that we need to get. We need to sort of do our West Wing weekly, but for The Wire.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
No, I'm serious about that. That's it. But, you know, the other ones aside, that's the one we need to do.
The Wire and Hamilton are the two most important American cultural artifacts of the 21st century. Hear me on this.
As an American, I agree. Yep. I can say that, right?
You can own that, yeah.
Done and dusted.
Yep. Anyway, we are way off topic.
This is good.
I hope people are enjoying this. This is a special episode. You can come back next week to do all the regular stuff.
I think Gruber would call this a holiday episode, yeah.
Yeah, except neither of us are actually drunk right now. That's fine.
No, not at all. But we were joking in sort of the pre-recording that it's that we've got all our elements. I've got my fussy coffee and my bubbly water, which are the tools of all podcasters. So.
We're all set. Alan Kay, I mean, what a treat to meet that guy. I mean, the bit I wanted to mention in case people are not that familiar with Alan Kay is, if you listen to this podcast, I insist that you go and find on the internet his paper from 1972 called A Personal Computer for Children of All Ages. Mm-hmm. And if people haven't read that, you must go and read it. I mean, like, pause the podcast and go and read that paper. Because essentially, in 1972, Alan Kay invented the iPad. And put it into an educational context.
Exactly. I was gonna sort of go Kanye and say, I'm going to stop you right there because you said it, 1972.
Yeah.
Like, that's it, 1972.
Yep.
That paper. Yeah.
And we actually teach that paper to students in our school. And I think it's so important that we do because I have this course that I love and I don't know if the children love it and I don't even care if the children love it because it's so important that it's called the History of Computing. And what we do is we look at all of the major phases of the evolution of computers because they know none of it and they will never derive any of it unless they have kind of, I suppose what I'm doing there is I'm encoding the experience of somebody born in the late 70s into like a modern history course for technology. And I think it's super important. And that's one of my kind of favorite lessons is, you know, this thing that you guys use every day that you totally take for granted, here's the original idea behind all of that. And this is, and look at what he said people were going to do with it. And now let's compare it with what we actually do with it. And it's my absolute favorite thing that I ever teach. I absolutely love it.
Oh, that's phenomenal. We always joke about that here is that all of the elective teachers want to take each other's electives. And on a similar note, like I absolutely want to take that course. Like I will, you know, take my sabbatical and come over and just, you know, shave my beard and sit as a student in class, you know.
That would be awesome. You're welcome anytime. Okay.
Cheers.
So we've maybe talked about what half of the event so far, and we're an hour into this.
Yeah, right.
You good to keep going?
Yeah, yeah, I'm good. I'm good. Do we need to, you know, take a break for Fracture or something like that, or?
Fracture.
You guys know Fracture, right?
Yeah. This is sounding more like Do by Friday, I have to say.
Yeah, cheers.
So what else stood out for you in this? Is there anything else that I've not pulled up as something that is obviously interesting just by the name?
I mean, beyond like, you know, sorry to go another Hamilton reference, but sort of beyond the like room where it happened, mm-hmm. being in this room with all these great minds, there were also a lot of colleagues that I've had sort of all over the world. And especially through Twitter, seeing them in the room and sort of like faces to a name, you know, like sort of like the moment that we met last year in person. It was sort of like, oh, absolutely. Like, we're ready to go. But seeing folks from both K-12 education, folks who are in different universities or different research institutions all around the world, being in sort of that room with them, sharing a cup of coffee, sharing a sort of a moment. There was the tinkering studio from the Exploratorium that I mentioned before. They had these sort of an exhibit set up in the common area where all the food and the coffee was, and they were making these. They do sort of a Lego tinkering. Mm-hmm. So they take a lot of the gears that they've stripped out of different Lego kits and make musical machines and things of that sort that are sort of like these automaton pieces working together, and it was absolutely phenomenal. Wow. To see that happening and to see sort of these kind of great minds of this movement there working together with, you know, K-12 teachers and, you know, just folks from all around working together through these processes. Like, it's those sort of happy accidents. You know, it wasn't quite like a conference, but to me, going to a professional development or a conference, it's always those moments in the hall, mm-hmm. Running into people that often end up being the most fruitful. So really kind of having those happy accidents of bumping into folks. I'm not sure how many people are going to know this, but I kind of snuck down to the lifelong learning kindergarten mm-hmm. Area and just kind of wanted to be in the room where Scratch was invented. Like, that was kind of interesting to sort of sneak down there. And, I kind of felt like, all right, I kind of walked down there and be like, hi, do you guys have any stickers? And I promised I wouldn't tell them, but they gave me a ton of stickers. But yeah, it was just sort of like being in that room and feeling inspired by the work that was done and the folks that are there. It was pretty special.
I had a similar experience a number of years ago in my previous job when I was working on the some clusters for the Large Hadron Collider project, and we used to go to CERN quite a lot in Geneva.
Oh yeah, no big deal, right?
No big deal. but I had the opportunity to visit Tim Berners-Lee's office where the web was invented, right? And that is something else, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So that's actually, like, that's the definition of no big deal, right?
Yeah, that was
come
cool.
On. Yeah. That's pretty impressive.
But what's funny about it is that the office actually was no big deal. Like, it was just, I mean, for you and I, or for right. mere mortals right. to see, like, where the web was invented. And at CERN, that's, like, 15 levels down on the achievement chart.
Right.
You know, Nobel Prizes.
Yeah, exactly.
All that kind of stuff.
I mean,
stuff,
it's all, it's relative in that sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah, for sure. That's pretty special.
Yeah, that is cool. So let me shift gears a little bit, and I'm going to throw out some of my hard questions for constructivist learning, because I'm a believer, right? But I'm also a guy who's trying to run a school and line up with curriculum requirements, and in particular, mm-hmm. as I've already mentioned, exam requirements, which are very not constructivist, and then universities right. who are like, what is constructivism in many parts? Mm-hmm. My big question, right, is what about assessment? You know, how do we scale that in terms of teacher time, student time, money cost, you know, paying mm-hmm. for people's time to assess, the complexity of assessment, the number of artifacts involved, and this is the one that nobody really wants to mention, is the relative ability of different teachers.
I like this. It's like the 6-part question. I'm going to go answer the one I want to answer first. Yeah.
Pick the one you like.
Yeah, well, I think just to begin, there's two sort of terms that run in parallel, this idea of constructivist and constructionist.
Okay.
And I'll sort of say constructivist and constructionist. Mm-hmm. So constructivism or constructivist thought is really comes out of Piaget's work in Geneva, and it's this idea that students do sort of form their own understandings in their minds on that knowledge is built in that way. And mm-hmm. then constructionist is Papert and sort of Edith Ackerman and this woman, Edith Harel, this idea that it's sort of constructivism plus the physical artifact.
So that's right? the sort of one you were referring to earlier.
Exactly, yeah. It's this idea that sort of students learn best when constructing their own understanding of something, and if they are in the process of making something physical or having something tangible, that sort of adds that other element of connection. So this sort of like the hand, the mind, and sort of this whole thought process is engaged together. So that's probably the worst definition that anyone's ever given for those two terms, but let's just go with it.
Okay.
There's a good book we'll put in show notes about constructionism in practice, mm-hmm. and it's sort of a compendium of a bunch of different work, including Papert and this woman, Yasmin Kafai, as well as the gentleman, Mitchell Resnick, that we talked about before. They're the editors of it, but we'll put it in there. It's sort of out of print, but you can find it in different used online retailers, we can say.
Okay.
We don't have an endorsement deal, do we?
Not this week.
No, we're good. Okay, cool. Yeah. No affiliate links there. Okay, cool. So anyway, so you can sort of explore a little bit more about constructionism there. But to get to your question that you asked about 2 minutes ago before I went on my own tangent, to me, the idea of constructivist and constructionist approaches, those really work well in forming a larger sort of culture of learning and teaching at a school. And whether they, you know, whether they're their own standalone subject, I really don't see it that way. Mm-hmm. I see it as a way of sort of permeating across the different subjects, as well as a way of blending or sort of blurring the lines between sort of these previous delineated subjects. So sort of an approach or a pedagogy in its own way that can sort of spin its way through these different subjects. And in terms of assessment, I mean, that's a legitimate question, and that's sort of something that we're all kind of looking at is what does assessment look like with this sort of, you know, new revolutionary style of learning? But in a way, we really try to focus on what that process is, that we sort of talked about that a little bit before, but how sort of process journals or how these documents that can sort of map the progress or sort of the path of knowledge acquisition and sort of this construction of knowledge that students have, what those can look like as an assessment in its own way. So, you know, sort of like if we can sort of think of the formative and the summative assessment, mm-hmm. where those kind of look like, where the formative is really really kind of the focus, whereas the summative is sort of less of a major piece, if that makes mm-hmm. any sense.
Mm-hmm. I've certainly used a couple of approaches like that sometimes in school. We do a unit called Making Multimedia, where the students have to, I've mentioned this several times on the show, but the students have to make a touchscreen kiosk for a museum using Keynote on the iPad. And one of the major parts of the rubric for that is, did you follow a certain process for it? You know, you have to select a topic, produce an outline, produce an information architecture, and then implement it. And they all have to line up. And there's a big part of the sort of summative scoring for that is that you started with one plan and you followed it through to here, and then you followed it through to here. And the connection between those three different artifacts is really a big part of what's being assessed, as well as the final thing, but also those connections in the process as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And for us here, we've been really working around this idea of design thinking, which mm-hmm. kind of is a counterpoint to that approach, where you sort of put yourself out in terms of identifying sort of the, you know, building a need statement. And a lot of that is work that students do through empathy. So in our build space, which is one of our two maker spaces here, students have sort of, it's been really interesting. We set up an email address and folks from within the community have been submitting project requests.
Okay.
And our middle school students have been going out and doing user interviews, sort of empathy interviews, and trying to figure out what the needs of the user are. And then from there, going through sort of a prototyping process, working with the user, and sort of making that final product. So, for instance, one of our second grade classrooms, the students had kind of this fidget stool, so sort of a way that a student can sort of rock rather than sitting in one place. And they had one in the classroom, but they needed another one. So some of our middle school students, our 7th and 8th graders, had gone down and done an interview with the classroom teacher and with some of the students, and sort of the students themselves kind of had an idea in their head what they wanted to build, but had gone through that process of sort of collecting the needs of the lead teacher in the classroom, as well as the students, and figuring out what that project would look like, and then sort of presenting a prototype. So not only following that sort of direct process, but also iterating as they go. And so in a way, to me, that kind of work is informed a lot by this idea of constructivism and constructionism, of working through that process in a way.
Yeah, I it's interesting. You know, you've got things like, you've got the design thinking concept that is, you know, increasingly popular. And I was speaking at an event just last week in London where the speaker before me was talking about doing that with, you know, I think like 11th and 12th grade students.
Right. We do it with kindergartners here, actually.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting to hear you talking about doing it younger, because they were doing it with kids in Denmark at that kind of upper, it's sort of late school, early college age, and talking about very, very kind of similar ideas again.
Right. It's really fascinating. And it's something that, to your point before about scale, it really can scale across different grade levels. So we actually have a really strong a program of design thinking in our early years, so in our K1 and 2, and we're looking at about how that can scale across the different grade levels here. A lot of times we can sort of say, oh, well, it's going to work easier with older kids, and then, well, that would be just fine. And that, I guess in a way, that kind of goes back to our point before about, like, well, the kids that are doing well are super easy to teach, but then it gets a little more challenging with this other group. So we're really kind of looking at, like, how does this scale across the different grade levels? So it's really interesting, and it's kind of a really fun thought experiment as well.
Yeah, I think you've got that, and then you've also got the idea of computational thinking as well. You know, because for me, sort of works in I kind of work in software, you know, and all my projects are virtual, they're software, soft artifacts, if you like. I've certainly, over the past couple of years, put a lot more focus on being very explicit about that as a thinking process as well. Whereas, I suppose, as a less experienced teacher, I sort of looked at that and thought, well, obviously, everybody's going to just understand that, right? If we just do programming, everybody's going to get the idea that you've got all these phases, because that was always like kind of so intuitive to me as a programmer, that I had the experience of university of sort of inventing these things just before people would teach me about them. It was kind of a weird time in my intellectual development, if you know what I mean.
But yeah, not to go off track, but in a way that kind of goes back to what Bradley had said, I think, either this week or the previous week on the episode, of saying about how the best players always make the worst managers, and you always kind of find the mediocre player is a great manager. And I feel like that sometimes in education, is that sort of like the thing that I'm really good at, I'm not sure I'm going to be the best teacher at, but the thing that I continue to learn while doing that's sort of, for me, that's kind of where the rubber meets the road. And that's what I've found in teaching design thinking and maker education, and to a point, coding or programming. And don't get mad at me for putting those two words in the same sentence, but I'm sort of learning as I go as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that sort of informs my practice, and I think our students see that as well.
And I believe very strongly that it's a very powerful thing to do if you can come to the place where you can do it, to let the students see you learn as well.
Yeah, like, agreed.
You know, and I mean, I'm teaching Swift programming, you know, for the first time this term, and I'm making mistakes in front of the class in a big way. You know, I am from time to time telling them the completely wrong thing. In fact, I did it just today when we were having a conversation about how the for loop iterator in Swift works, and I got it completely wrong, and I talked for like 5 minutes, and I said, "Hang on a minute, could you just sort of forget everything I just said? Because I've just realized something myself."
But Fraser, how powerful is that for your students to see as well, as sort of in that moment where they can reflect on their learning process, that you know someone as knowledgeable as you are, and I can say that about you, you can't, you know, you're not allowed to, nope. You know, being as humble as you are, but seeing someone who's, you know, really amongst the leaders in his field, having that moment of like, oh, actually, I'm not really sure, let's figure this out together. And this kind of goes to your point of this discussion about educators. To me, the real value there is an educator that's willing to continue to learn. And we're really lucky here at this school to have a good number of folks who are, you know, a majority of our folks are really excited about learning new things. And to me, that's always been one of the most exciting parts of educators, is that desire to keep learning. And you know, sometimes it can be super scary when the students know more than you, or, you know, will call you out on something. But, you know, that's sort of a really – it's a great lesson for them that you don't have to sort of stand up and be the know-it-all all the time, that you can sort of be in that moment of learning with them.
Yeah, it takes a certain level of experience, I think, as well. You know, younger teachers don't always seem – I know I wasn't as a young teacher, and I'm in no way criticizing any young teacher for not feeling that way, because, you know, often in the early part of your career, you're just so afraid of losing control that everything is kind of focused around that. But
I mean, this is sort of a moment where I keep like being like, hey, you remember that one time at band camp? But like looking back on my notes from the symposium last week, this gentleman, Todd Machover, said, instead of being experts, let's set up an environment where we're all learners, adventurers, and explorers. And I really like that idea. Instead of saying, this is the expert in the room and you're going to learn everything you need to know from that person, what about creating an environment where we're all learners, where we're all adventurers, and we're all explorers? And I really like that idea.
Yeah, that's powerful, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I think we've probably exhausted all of the references we can make, and all of the
I know
much of the patience of our listeners as well, I'm sure.
But Bradley's going to be so mad at me. He's like, do you remember that time you ruined my podcast? You
know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see our subscriber numbers going down over time.
Yeah.
But I mean, for personally, this has been fascinating, and I hope you know, I kind of feel like I was almost there a little bit. So I really appreciate you, you know, sharing your notes and sharing your insight with us.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really, as such a fan of the show, it's such a pleasure to be on. And I really have to applaud you guys for doing such a great job, and for keeping the lights on and really, really carrying it through. You guys are phenomenal. So keep it up.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, for listeners who have made it this far to the show, thank you for listening as well. We'll have a bunch of show notes and a number of links, including I see that we've got a link here to the archive video of is it the entire day, pretty much?
Yeah, I believe it's a video of the whole symposium. Okay. And if you're sort of somebody that really likes to at reply, you can sort of listen through and call out where I misquoted someone here or there, please. Please, yeah, send all those to Fraser.
Yeah. And what we'll do as well is I'll get together links to the various books and things that we've mentioned, the Papert books and the other publications that are here as well, and we'll try and make the show notes a real jumping off point for people. You know, if you're not familiar with this material, or, you know, familiar with the people we've mentioned, we'll try and hopefully this show will have, you know, piqued your interest, and then you can use the show notes to follow the parts that you're particularly interested in.
Right, and to sort of reiterate, this is something that Fraser and I are learning ourselves, so we're there with you.
Definitely.
If you guys, if there's anything that you all come up with, please hit us up. This is like a learning journey for us.
Always. So, Nicholas, thanks again. Really appreciate it. And everybody
excellent.
Else,
thank you, sir.
We'll see you next time.
Excellent.
Thank
Cheers.
You.